I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is the national debt. In particular, the Canadian national debt in the 19th century. There's an old saying that you've got to speculate to accumulate. And that's what Canadians did in the 19th century, engaging in land speculation, accumulating debt in order to finance large-scale projects. And this, of course, came at the expense of Indigenous peoples all across the territory of what would become Canada. And as a result, those projects and the debt that was used to finance them, part of the larger colonial project. And that is the subject of a new book by Angela Tozer entitled The Debt of a Nation, Land and the Financing of the Canadian Settler State, 1820 to 73. This is a really fascinating book because it not only gets into questions of colonialism and land speculation and how the colonial project financed itself, but also gets into the nuts and bolts of how debt works and how debt accumulation can be beneficial to both those who hold the debt and those who provide the capital funds required to finance large scale projects. So every year when the budget comes out, we hear about the debt, both the immediate deficit of that budget, haven't had a surplus in Canada in at least a decade, but then also the implications on the larger national debt. And this book, while it is set in the 19th century and looks at the evolution and growth of national debt in that period, really does speak to a lot of issues today and how the colonial project, the colonial framework still influences a lot of our investment at the national level. So a fascinating book. And Angela was great when I talked to her, not only about the intricacies of this topic, which can be a little difficult to follow for those of us like myself who are not experts in the financial field, but also in contextualizing it with these much larger ideas and the significance of how this operated at the time, but also its long-term implications. So really fascinating chat. I very much enjoyed it. We talked before the new year. This was mid-December-ish. I was hoping to get it out before the end of 2025. Unfortunately, I could not do that, but I am very happy that it's coming out now here as we kick off 2026. So without any further ado, let's get right into my chat with Angela Tozer. All right. And Angela Tozer joins me now. Angela, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you doing, Sean?
Doing really well. Very happy to have you here to talk about The Debt of a Nation, Land and the Financing of the Canadian Settler State, 1820 to 1873. Angela, before we get into some of the specifics of the book, I'm curious about where this idea came from for you. Like what got you interested in the idea of financing and land and public debt? It's, you know, a lot of historians that we've had on the show before, when we talk about a lot of colonial issues, we talk about land and settlement and that, but not from this perspective. So I don't really know this side of the field that well, the literature of it, but you know, how active is the field and what brought you into this particular part of the colonial state?
Yes. Thanks for that question. And thanks for having me here. I'm really excited to talk to you today, and hello to your listeners. So that's a question. This book was actually developed out of my dissertation, and it kind of came out of questions that I've always been fascinated about, like in my graduate studies work with political economists like John Stuart Mill, and as I talk about in the book, like Edward Gibbon Wakefield, particularly in this really fascinating period just right before Canadian Confederation, where all of these British political economists start talking about settler colonialism, particularly in the context of Canada. So I just became interested in why that was. And my first instinct was to, as Catherine Hall was doing this big project, who's this really, of course, famous British historian, about following the money, like with respect to the payout to former slaveholders after the abolition of the slave trade in the British Empire. So there was kind of at that time, like this follow the money kind of idea. So I'm like, are they profiting from this? Is David Ricardo, is John Stuart Mill, is Edward Wakefield profiting from settler colonialism? Why is John Stuart Mill writing about this so much? So then I just went to the London Stock Exchange archive just to kind of look up that stuff. I went to like John Stuart Mill's archive at the some other archives as well. And I kind of developed from there. So I didn't really like start by thinking about the public debt at all. I started from this perspective of why are these political economists so deeply invested in, you know, so much invested that they're basically reforming the idea of political economy itself around the settler colonies and investment into the settler colonies. So that's how I started. And it led me to the London Stock Exchange archive, which is in the Guildhall Law Library in London. And just looking through those records, and I just noticed, you know, like you do, you're just looking, and these records are all just lists of numbers and, you know, very tedious to look through. But then I just noticed like, well, you know, there was a period where there aren't these Canadian securities being listed, and then there are. And then I started like, what are these Canadian securities? Where are they coming from? Their public debts being listed on the London Stock Exchange, like starting in 1837. And then you can see like going forward in time, this exponential explosion of investment in particularly in, I'm going to say Canadian securities, but I mean like colonial government securities. So the individual colonial governments, like the province of Canada, New Brunswick, et cetera. And then the Dominion securities after Confederation. So that's kind of where it started. It was just like following some questions and it led me here. And then I just started kind of researching on Canada's public debt and questioning how they were able to borrow money. Because, you know, just like if you try to go to a bank today and you ask them to borrow money, they're not going to give you money unless you had some sort of credit there, right? So you can trace very easily in the Receiver General or those account books of the colonial governments that they're counting all of these unceded, unsurrendered territories of Indigenous nations as a part of their assets. So they're borrowing against this money very clearly. And the bankers, the big banks in London are, you know, forking over all this capital. And then they're using this capital to build these big infrastructure projects. And I think one of the key things is they're doing it at a low interest rate because they're within this sphere of the British Empire. So that's where I started from, grad work and following questions about money, and ended up here.
Right. Well, it's the old saying, you know, the answer to all your questions, all life's questions is money, right? You figure it out. So in terms of this idea of debt, right, we talk about debt a lot, like the budget came out, whatever it was a few weeks ago, nationally, and a lot of talk about debt. And I think the way a lot of people, myself included, understand public debt is that the government issues bonds, people buy the bonds, and then at some point in the future, the bond pays out. And the government theoretically uses that money in the moment to invest so that there will be more money later to repay the bond, and everything comes out equal. Is that roughly the same idea of what you're dealing with in the 19th century and the debt on the stock exchange? Is it roughly that, or is there any difference in how you are the debt that you're looking at compared to sort of that very basic understanding I think most of us have about public debt now?
Yeah, I would say like now it's, like I use the word exponential a lot, it's just so complicated right now. The way that stock exchanges work, like you would need very advanced, like an individual human being would not, unless you were like, I don't know, a savant in mathematics, like you couldn't access those types of markets, like trading on those types of markets. It's extremely complicated. One of the things that I find very interesting about these debts from the 1820s onwards is that they were not complicated because there was only like maybe one of them, right? So in the case of, for example, Prince Edward Island, one of the chapters in the books traces Prince Edward Island's public debt. So very early on, they only have about like a 30,000, they're only borrowing, and you can find how they're borrowing in the legislation, because all borrowing has to be legislated. And this legislation acts as a contract, kind of in the same way a mortgage would act between yourself and the bank. So it's holding that government accountable. So they have like amortization period, they have interest rates, they have, if there's a sinking fund, like all that kind of stuff, amortization period being when you have to pay it back. And so you can just look at the one act and look in the account records at this $30,000 and see kind of easily where it's going. And that quickly changes within, I would say, a couple of decades in the case of PEI, because what ends up happening is that 20 years or whatever that amortization period is due. And usually you don't borrow large sums of money if you can afford something, you know, that's generally how things work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, plus you have to pay an interest rate. So it becomes due. So what the governments end up doing, the colonial governments, is just passing another act. So let's say they owe £18,000. They pass an act for £19,000, pay off the previous one, and now they have this new act. So basically right. They're just restructuring the debt. And so these mechanisms of debt restructuring start to become extremely complicated, particularly around the time of the late 19th century after Confederation. So there's all sorts of ways of moving debt packages between accounts, different accounts, with different interest rates. And it becomes very difficult to trace where that money is moving to, where those interest rates are coming from, to the point where even in the like parliamentary debates, there's not even agreement, and it's not like partisan. There's just people aren't agreeing if moving some debt account into another account and charging interest on that constitutes as asking for a new debt or restructuring debt, or is it just new capital? Like, so people can't even agree on those kind of simple things, the simple ideas, right, because of how complicated it becomes. So I think even in this idea that the public debt even now is like the government issues bonds and then we all as individuals purchase these bonds, like that is, that's not exactly how it works either, right? Because that capital is all coming in, and it depends. There's different types of debt securities as well, like security instruments, debt instruments. It's like debentures or bonds, which I won't go into right now. But so it really becomes so complicated and complex and how those debts are understood as financial instruments, how they're being moved around, who's investing in them, even the banks themselves. Like mostly in the 19th century, it's the big London banks, the Barings and Glyn Halifax and Co. and other ones that are giving this big chunk of money, like a credit card, like I say, the capital. And then the securities are issued on the stock exchange, and it's those securities that are traded. But the securities market for these debts are so very low volume. So other kind of mechanisms come in. So like companies come in that start guaranteeing, start like purchasing all of these securities and then selling them as a third party to individuals. Like, so it becomes very complex and very quickly. So I would say to answer your question, it's actually extremely complex. And if you were to take like the revenues of the Canadian government right now, and like one question I get a lot from usually audience members, places I give talks or reviewers is, well, you're not telling us what the exact numbers are, because it's very difficult to understand. Like it's hard to say. And a lot of that is speculative value, right? So if they're taking out a debt, you're taking out a 20 million pound debt or something based on this idea that you're going to develop this land as mining, as a canal, and 30 years from now, it's going to be worth $80 million. Those numbers aren't real, right? Like that, right, that $80 million isn't real. They're also like making these plans with respect to like the Welland Canal, which is the first kind of big infrastructure project, and just coming up with numbers of how much it's going to cost. And it's way, way under calculated. So then they have to take out more money, and it eventually, yeah, gets absorbed into the province of Canada government. But yeah, it's very complex, and it is so localized on what, like, depending on what debt we're talking about and where. It's just very difficult. I think you could do it if you had computer skills and math skills that I don't have. You could maybe trace that, but yeah.
So I'm curious though, how does land then get involved? Because you're talking about like accounts and shifting money around and like creative accounting and all that. And like as a government, I guess you're saying to investors or whoever, like to get this loan or to take this debt, you're saying, all right, we'll invest in this thing. It'll generate revenue. It'll be worth this amount. But if you compare it, say you made the comparison to a mortgage, like if I don't pay my mortgage, the bank's going to take my house back. Right. So for a government to put up land, does it work in the same way that it is serving as that collateral such that if the government theoretically can't repay the loan, the bank then takes the land? Is that functionally how they're operating?
Well, there's been instances in which there were big defaults. Like, so for example, the Southern states after the American Revolutionary War defaulted all their debts. What happened in that case? And it's in the American Constitution, like these so-called rebel like states were not paying for your debts. So they were getting funding through the stock exchange to pay for the American Civil War, for their Southern states against the Northern states. But what happened in that case when they defaulted, the bondholders association tried to bring a lawsuit against them. Like, so it's interesting. And there's also this interesting moment in the late 19th century, because debts were actually very seen as very morally wrong to have, to the point where you would be even imprisoned up until the mid 19th century. So there's this interesting shift in how particularly political economists are pushing this idea of debts as actually it's not morally wrong. You're just a really suave businessman if you can have these debt contracts and you're accessing this capital and you're investing it, right? So there's a point where people are very opposed to having these big public debts, like in the case of Prince Edward Island. But then it becomes, well, actually the debt isn't a problem as long as we keep having credit. So then there becomes this kind of expansionary mechanism that I talk about being encoded into the Canadian economy. So that credit is always there as long as you keep expanding and doing these development projects, right? And keep pushing into or invading Indigenous nations' territories. So it becomes part of this mechanism of the Canadian economy. There's also like, what do the banks get out of this? The bank has a vested interest in keeping you indebted forever because you're paying interest, right? So if you have, a 999-year lease or whatever, you're just paying interest for your whole life. You don't actually own that. So there's both sides are kind of interested in never paying off that debt. Mm. Alberta famously defaulted its debt. There was the kind of post 2008 Greek attempt to default their debt. But in those cases as well are kind of forced into these austerity positions where they have to take on more debt. And what ends up happening in those cases is that the public or the citizens in the case of Canada are the ones that get their services cut. And so, maybe sometimes more tax dollars go to funding things. So it's, again, it's very complicated, but the structure of the system itself is to promote, as I write in the book, like structural indebtedness becomes accepted.
Right.
I had a student ask me once, like, what if Canada just chooses to default on its debt? Because, the debt itself, our public debt, and because if you are to believe what I'm saying, has this expansionary mechanism that's constantly pushing for development. And if you don't even like, maybe you don't, you're not too interested in Indigenous sovereignty or Indigenous nations, there's also the ecological crisis question as well, right? We're constantly doing these development projects that have very low value for the average person and very high impact on the environment and ecological disaster. That kind of expansionary mechanism is not the choice of any individual. So the student asks, what happens if Canada defaults on the debt? But the question becomes like, can it default on the debt will the other kind of, you know, like the IMF, like other kinds of entities force that payment and continuation of this kind of capitalist credit debt model. So, yeah, it's a tough question to ask, but it also is, if you're looking at this as ongoing colonialism, it is one of the ways in which that facilitates colonialism, right? Access to indigenous nations' territories.
Right. And so from a practical perspective, why does the appropriation of land need to be involved in this process, right? Like historically, European settlers have not had any qualms about taking land from indigenous peoples, right? That's kind of the history of settler colonialism, certainly in Canada. So why does the land appropriation, how does it get included into this process of public debt?
Yeah, so that's an interesting one. And of course, there were this like violent, and they're still ongoing, this particularly where I live now in Wissahickon territory and Wabanaki territory around the fisheries question of like settler violence against indigenous fishers. So of course that was happening, right? Where you have individual settlers acting violently and squatting and all the rest of it, all these other types of legal mechanisms. But if you think about how Canada claims its territory, about 89% of that claimed territory is crown lands. So it's not privately owned in what's called fee simple or a private property. And so if you're asking why does land have to be involved in this equation? And it has to do with like questions around security and title, like land title. So Canada like inherited this, what's called the Royal Proclamation of 1763. And it ended the 7 years war between Britain and France that was kind of fought all over the place, but here as well. And so what ended up happening after the 7 years war is that France cedes all of its colonial territory to Britain. And then Britain, King George III, issues this royal proclamation and says that the British crown has the highest title to all this land. And so that individual settlers cannot sell or buy land, allegedly, it's not actually what happens, or private corporations from Indigenous nations. So in this right, this is still the kind of private property framework that we work in now. Even if you own like property, the Crown, the Canadian Crown now, still has the right to expropriate that land from you under the guise of like the public good or resource development or whatever, right?
Right. Like I've read, for instance, in the context of the high-speed train project in the Windsor, Quebec City corridor, that appropriation of land through eminent domain is a possibility, right? So is that the sort of thing that, all right, so the government decides this project is really important. We need this territory. Thanks for your land.
Well, you would you're supposed to be compensated, but it's so this idea of private property as like you own the land, sure. But if you say you bought 120 acres, like I don't know, like around Sudbury or something, you can't then put a fence around that 120 acres and then declare your own laws and declare your own economy. And you know, so it has to do with sovereignty and jurisdiction as well. So why does Britain do this at this time in 1763? Well, so then what happens if France comes back over and just like puts up a colony? Is that land France now? So if when the British Crown is claiming all this land, it means it's under British sovereignty, under British laws, under British jurisdiction, not so much with Indigenous nations. Like it's interesting how little of that is a consideration because there are already these pre-existing treaty relationships. But so that other European nations don't start claiming these territories. Like, remember, because they have this ideology of the doctrine of discovery, all you have to do is occupy the land and therefore it's Britain's land. So then if you have that logic, if the French come and occupy the land, is it France, right? So these types of protections are to advance British imperialism against other forms of, in a way, other forms of European imperialism. So the land title becomes very important. And maybe to answer that question, like thinking about what was popular before the public debt of the 1820s were these kind of what were called land colonization companies. And they're always interested in getting British settlers over to work as laborers. And I won't kind of get into the, like the white supremacy and like racial logics of that right now, but, but British settlers, a lot of like, they don't want to leave their ancestral homes. It's very expensive to get people over here and then set them up and then ask them to do hard labor, basically, away from all their family. And, you know, so how do you get laborers over here? How do you get them to stay? How do you develop the land? So these land colonies basically had to pay for them themselves, or they would get grants from the British government. Or they would have these lords, like Lord Selkirk would, you know, the British government would say, if you bring over X amount of settlers, you can have X amount of land. But again, it was very expensive. They didn't own those land companies, the Hudson's Bay Company. They didn't own the land title, so they couldn't go to a bank and borrow against it. So there was no way to access this like low interest, giant amounts of unprecedented amounts of capital. But the land title becomes important as a part of that government asset. So if you look at like what they're including as their revenue when they're going to pitch for a loan in London, like sailing over to London, going to talk to the Barings Bank, and saying like, we have all these assets, we have revenue from the St. Lawrence River, X amount, we have X amount of land that's going to be worth this in the future. So they create this speculative idea of like how much this will be worth, how much revenue is going to be generated in the future. So with the Welland Canal, they can say, once it's done, it's going to generate X amount of revenue. And that money becomes real in the context of this pitch to these banks, and the bank can choose to believe them or not. They do. And so they give them this capital, right? Because they are claiming to hold all this land. How else would you do that? So where else would that credit derive? And this is kind of a question I ask myself. If we're talking about moving towards like a anti-colonial, anti-imperial, debt-free future, that value and that capital would have to come from somewhere else, right? That's a very interesting question that I don't really have an answer to right now, but.
Well, the question that I would ask to that is, does it have to be the land itself as opposed to the resources, right? Like we've talked about, it's a speculative investment. And so the Welland Canal on its own, say, if we use that example, the canal isn't really worth anything. It's what the canal allows to happen. Yeah. It allows the transportation. Same thing with, say, where the land where you're hunting, right? The land itself, like it's land, but it's generating revenue because of, if it's the Hudson Bay Company, like the beavers or the bison, the things that you're hunting, the things that you're extracting from it. So from a speculative perspective, why does it have to necessarily be the land that strips away the rights of indigenous nations as opposed to the resources that are generated from the land?
So let's say the treaties were respected and it's the jurisdiction of the, for example, the Wolastoqiyik Nation, who has in the framework of like this British property title, the highest title to land. That title isn't secure for those for the companies that are investing. And there's actually a case in Prince Edward Island around like the 187, like late 19th century, where they're talking about creating the first quote unquote reserve, like Mi'kmaq Reserve, which is Lenox Island on Prince Edward Island, where other companies like the New England Company is interested in investing, like paying for the reserve because of the way PEI was all owned by these landowners through a lottery system. I won't get into it, but so this outside company wanted to pay for it, but they're very clear they wanted the land title. They wanted the security that the land title offered. Hmm. And in that land title, it's like, what is securitizing that land title for safe investment, quote unquote, non-risk or low risk investment? Is this entire legal framework that is basically underwritten by the violence of the state. So what happens then if you put up a blockade like land and water defenders in Elsa Booktook, you know, against fracking, well, then you can maybe get an injunction because of the legal system. You have recourse in that legal system to get an injunction to allow the RCMP, or in the case of Gunasatage, like during the so-called Oka crisis of 1990, role in the military, because that land is considered, the highest title is the crown. So the right of violence then is with the state. So there's an entire like violent colonial framework that is securitizing that land. So if you're just extracting the resources, you couldn't guarantee to, or how would you guarantee to the bank or to your investors that people can't interfere with that, that it's secure title, that it can go on in perpetuity, that you would be able to fulfill your debt contract, right? So in that case, in the late 19th century with the New England Company, they pulled out and said, no, the land title isn't secure here. We're not going to invest in this. And that's happened before with other like pipeline projects. So,
So, okay. So that, I get that. That makes sense. And then if you go forward and counterfactual history, I know is dangerous and we should never do it, but was there ever any discussion of, well, the First Nations who are there, who we have treaties with, and in a lot of cases know the land, know how to use the resources, probably to their greatest effect. Was there ever any idea of working with them or having the nations themselves be the ones who are taking out the debt to invest and to engage in this process? Or was it always colonial state and never any thought to engaging with First Nations and respecting the treaties?
It's interesting because there's a way that private property is incommensurate with the treaty relationship. And of course, like Indigenous nations all have their own governance systems and, systems of knowledges and things like this. So I don't want to speak for all of them. But one of the kind of pro-colonial pieces of legislation that, you know, the Harper government, which is very kind of infamous for doing this, tried to put in was privatization of reserve lands, which did happen in a very limited case, in the case of Nisga Nation. So what happens when you create private, you have to have that private property in order to borrow against it. But the way that treaty protection is the so-called reserves, like where Indigenous communities are, where it's the Canadian government, quote unquote, recognizing, and that's a very loaded term, recognizing that these are under what's called in Canadian law, Aboriginal title. So they can't just come in and take over or chip away at that land or sell it to other settlers. So in a way it's protected very imperfectly, but it is still protected in a way by this, you know, race law that Canada still has in place, the Indian Act, which is sometimes called a double-edged sword because it's what's holding the Canadian government accountable to not just announcing that all Indigenous peoples are Canadian citizens and eradicating their nations, right? Which is something that they tried to do with Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, with the White Paper and Jean Chrétien at that time in the 1960s. So So thinking about it as like an incommensurate system, to borrow against land would mean to put it in the market, the capitalist global market. It would also mean the treaties are relationships, right? They're describing the relationship, not just between humans, like a nation to nations relationship, but between humans and other than human beings, the land. So that kind of, whereas in this capitalist model, it's about as much resource extraction at the most profit as possible at the expense of labor and the environment and all the rest of it, which is incommensurate with these ideas, right, of living in the land. So just an example of that with the, for example, Mi'kmaq fishers fishing, they would shut down their fishing operations if there was like right whales passing through because they're protecting those whales. Or is that's not a consideration of the big offshore trawler, you know?
Right. Fishers. So it's more reciprocal relationship with the land. Of the land gives us sustenance, but we give back to the land by protecting it, and that's not also how a capitalist enterprise will ever work.
That's right. And also, once those lands become private property, anyone can buy them, and then that territory of that indigenous nations will shrink, right? Which is obviously self-explanatory why that's a problem. So,
right. So, I'm curious then, if we think forward, right, the book ends in 1873. So is there a real break with Confederation and the pre-Confederation debts that are accumulated across the provinces of Canada versus what happens post-Confederation and, the end point of 1873? So what precipitates that just from a functional research standpoint?
That's when PEI joined Confederation. That was like the last piece of the puzzle. So what ends up happening, if you look at the British North America Act, there's a whole section on like what's going to go happen to all these provincial debts. And of course, when PEI joins, they get all their debts paid off. Then they're able to borrow money. That's like the first time they're able to get their debt listed on the stock exchange for their speculation on the railway. And I also always get this question, like, where was the railway supposed to go? It doesn't matter where it goes, right? It only matters that you're producing this kind of speculative value for investment. Does it matter for the people that live there or for the environment? No, but does it matter for the shareholders who get out in time and make a lot of money off of it? Yes. So these types of development projects, so many of them are failures, like in any sort of sense of the term. But for a short while, they produce a lot of market value for the people who are invested in them. So what ends up happening is the federal government is supposed to take responsibility of all these provincial debts. So it becomes this like one Dominion debt. But the problem with that is like the provincial governments prior to Confederation already took out a whole bunch of other debts that were due past the Confederation date. So they just keep like ongoing.
Right.
But they're supposed to be under like the jurisdiction of but that kind of all gets sorted out eventually. But with respect to how it's working different, I mean, there's the differing jurisdictions between the provincial and the federal government. Interestingly too, it's not just like the governments that are capable of taking out these debts, right? This is when you get this major kind of push towards incorporation with cities, universities, because with that incorporation becomes the ability to own property, take out debt, mortgages, things like this. So it becomes like a whole framework for how to access capital. And if you're a big government that looks very secure and risk-free, you can take out low interest loans, 3%, 4%, versus like prior to, I mean, public debts always existed, but sometimes the interest rates could be like 50%, like, which is, who can afford that, right? But it is technically possible to just keep a 3% loan going for a long time. So,
right.
Well, it's going still. So,
well, sure. Yeah. So with the notion of this too, right? It's interesting that you say that a lot of these projects were failures in terms of actually producing anything. It kind of, would it be fair to say that there's a land speculation bubble then that kind of burst second half of the 19th century? And, I'm not a 19th century historian, but I have a rough idea that things were not good economically in the second half of the 19th century. That's in my head for whatever reason. But is this really...
There's a bunch of banking failures and stuff that happen. Yeah.
Is that all related to this speculative investment environment?
I think like what fails is what the government allows to fail, right? So if we think about 2008, I mean, even now, like we have this epic housing crisis, and like where I live in Fredericton, like when I moved here in 2020 was just like right before this ridiculous property bubble, right? But those types of things are upheld like by various mechanisms, political mechanisms, legal mechanisms. So the question is like, did that bubble on land ever burst because it's constantly going up? There's a really interesting book called Railroaded by Richard White, where he talks about in the American context, how the railroad was developed. It became this like amazing speculative venture, right? It didn't have to actually go anywhere. It could just, you just propose it and, you know, create a story around it and say, like, at the end of this railroad line, which is by a lake, we're going to build this huge town and access this gold mine, and it's going to be worth millions in the future, right? And people just have to buy into it and invest in it, and then it fails. A really big project, maybe close to where you are, is the Trent Severn Waterway. That's a really epic failure. That really was extremely destructive to Anishinaabe territory. And now it's all like Toronto cottage country, right? So the food sources, the life systems that were there, where there's like Anishinaabe, like food sovereignty, like land and water defenders planting like manumin, the wild rice there, that particular waterway, it's like basically didn't generate any value at all. It was hugely expensive. It took a huge amount of time to accomplish. But if you go to Peterborough, there's like the national historic site, the Trent Severn Waterway, right? Yeah. Like, so there's this entire like national narrative around this, let's linking development projects, the Canadian economy to colonialism, but also at the same time, like erasing colonialism, right? Yeah. And so it's these failures are allowed to keep going because of this public investment. If the companies, like for example, let's say the Welland Canal Company, if it could fund itself, it can't, right? These pipeline companies are not funding themselves, like mining companies are not funding themselves. So they get public investment, and that's the public investment is the debt.
Right. Right. And so this book and what you're talking about here, yes, it's obviously a 19th century history book, but clearly ramifications and implications for the 21st century in terms of understanding the way public investment and public debt functions, and the legacy of the 19th century certainly influences today, right? Like we just saw the budget, new announcements by the federal government. Like this is all sort of legacy stuff related to what you're tracking in this book.
Yeah, one Canadian economy, right? From the PhD from Oxford in economics and former governor bankers of Canadian Bank Canada, Bank of England, right? Mark Carney. So I wouldn't say it was like think of it maybe, I think of it more as like a structure that was in place, that gets put in place in the 1820s, 1830s, and then just builds itself out. And it's basically the fundamental structure that we still are working with today. Which is to pay for these large infrastructure projects, we have to borrow. And in order to borrow, we have to have good credit. In order to have good credit, we have to have this access to land and secure land title, which means pushing into unceded, unsurrendered Indigenous territories and ignoring treaty laws, which are, right, you know, built in an international legal framework. So,
right. It's like the dog chasing its tail, essentially. Right?
And it's like, interesting because if you read the One Canadian Bill stuff, rhetoric around it, there's a lot of, you know, discussion around consultation of Indigenous peoples, but you wouldn't really see understanding Indigenous nations because that would mean recognizing sovereignty, or you wouldn't really see the word treaty, or I haven't come across that, right? It's in this framework of consultation, which could mean anything. It could mean we gave the community some pamphlets. It could mean we have a investment from the community. Like it could mean consultation is not free, prior, and informed consent, which is what a nation would give.
Right. Yeah. So really, really interesting stuff here, and would certainly check, or would certainly encourage everybody to go check out the book. Again, it is The Debt of a Nation, Land and the Financing of the Canadian Settler State, 1820 to 73. But of course, as we say, like a lot of implications for today and trying to understand the situation, not only of the 19th century, but today. So Angela, if people want to get a copy of the book, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, we were lucky enough to secure some funding for open access. So if you go to the UBC Press website, like where the book is located, like just type it in. You can scroll down and it says download. And you can also, if you would like to purchase a copy that way as well, but it's also open access.
We will link down in the show notes below a link to the UBC Press site where you can get a copy of the physical book, or if you want to get the open access version. So be sure to check it out. Angela Tozer, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, and hope you have a great day.
So there you have it, my chat with Angela Tozer. I thank her for her time. And again, the book is The Debt of a Nation, Land and the Financing of the Canadian Settler State, 1820 to 73. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week. Going a bit different today. Going to pull something from the economic and fiscal snapshot that the Government of Canada put out for fiscal year 2020-2021. This was, of course, in the context of the pandemic and the significant expenditures that came along with that for the federal government. And the part that I'm going to link to, it's an annex from that document that is entitled Debt Management Strategy for 2020-2021. And it attempts to put the modern Canadian debt into context as to why the federal debt increased at that time, while also trying to forecast, as it relates to percent of GDP, both the federal debt, but also the debt charges, so the cost of servicing that debt within the context of the GDP. We can look back now on these numbers and see how accurate they were, because they're forecasts. But it's an interesting snapshot into how the federal government perceives its debt, understands its debt, and forecasts out what the implications are of holding that debt. And as it relates to the pandemic, as it says in this document, the argument that was made at the time was that these investments were necessary to not only sustain people who had lost their jobs owing to the circumstances of social distancing and people not going out as much, and the rules that were put in place by governments at all levels, but also looking at some of the long-term benefits of big capital investments, that some of which were going on at this time. So it's a really fascinating snapshot. It's a little different from what I would normally post for the historical headline of the week, but given what we talked about with Angela and the significance of capital investment, what that means, how speculative holdings can influence debt, I think all of that comes through a little bit here. And so this is a more modern version, of course, than the 19th century. But a lot of the issues that she talked about come through a bit in this document. So that's going to be today's historical headline of the week, this annex, Debt Management Strategy for 2020-2021, as part of that year's economic and fiscal snapshot. So with that, I'll say thank you so much for listening, everybody. Happy 2026 to you all. I hope the new year finds you well. Very much appreciate you listening. And of course, if you want to find all of our other episodes and what we got coming up, which should be a fun year for us here on the show, please do subscribe wherever it is you get your podcast. Like, rate, comment, all that good stuff helps other people find the show. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca, all the great written material over there on the website, including, if you missed it back in December, the year in review, 100 years later, Aaron Boys and I, our 13th edition. Pretty sure it was the 13th of the year in review, 100 years later. So we looked at 1925, a lot going on back 100 years ago. So be sure to check that out and all the written material over there on the website. Of course, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, it's oldisnews@gmail.com. So with that, I'll say thanks again so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again real soon for more What's Old Is News.